Well, hello and welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book The Cruises of the Joan by W.E. Sinclair. We're on part 8 and we're starting chapter 14. Now, if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support the podcast. We can keep recording these books and we can keep them in the hands of sailors like yourself for many years to come. Now on with the story. Chapter 14. Funchal to Falmouth. Our friend Coelho gave us a tow out of Funchal Bay on Wednesday afternoon, August the 5th. An enthusiastic amateur photographer was on the tug, and the pictures which he took of us we found waiting our homecoming when we reached Erith nearly 3 months later. Until our tow rope was cast off, the Joan carried a crew of friends who patted us on the back, drank our health, and made a cheerful and inspiring event of our farewell. I saw the last of Funchal with regret and turned to the work of sailing to England with some misgiving. The passage was not only a long one in actual distance, but the prevailing winds were against us. The sailing directions advised going west of the Azores in order to pick up a fair wind which would take us home. The captain of one boat in Funchal Bay advised us to go to the West Indies instead. It was a fair wind all the way and a simple matter, he said, and he thought our chances of reaching England were poor. Must we go west of the Azores? I asked him. Isn't it possible to pick up a wind good enough for us without going so far out of our way? He thought it possible. Anything was possible. This non-committal frame of mind in the professional was not calculated to encourage a couple of amateurs. We made up our minds to do whatever the wind would allow. We would go north and west if by that course we made northing satisfactorily. It all depended on the wind. As things turned out, we kept east of the islands, and we were never within 200 miles of them. For 2 days, we potted about in light airs before we found a true breeze. Then we considered we were again in the track of our former friend, the trade wind. But it was now no longer a friend to us, for it prevented our sailing directly on our course. It was light, and we put the Joan on the starboard tack so as to sail out into the Atlantic towards the northwest. The further we went in this direction, the greater our chances of finding a westerly wind which would have sent us home. It was not until 5 weeks had passed that we found that westerly wind. During most of this time, life was very slow and exceedingly pleasant. The sun shone warm upon us all day, and we joyfully soaked our skins in its beams. We both had bodies that could stand a deal of this treatment, and as we liked it, we took the opportunity of getting our fill of it. We varied the treatment by having at frequent intervals what Byford called a Dutch bath. He explained that this was merely pouring seawater over your head. When the air and sea were both warm, it was pleasant enough, and it was easy to practice these methods of bathing in our situation. Byford called me out one afternoon to look over the side. I went forward, caught hold of the starboard shroud, and nearly fell overboard with fright. An 8-foot shark, accompanied by 2 pilotfish, beautifully marked with blue and silver bands, was swimming silently round the Joan. The 3 fish manoeuvred like a squad at drill. They would hide under the keel for a minute or two, and then suddenly appear by the side of the cockpit within 2 feet of the steersman, at whom the shark gazed with his big, wicked eyes in an attempt to fascinate him into falling into the water. Overboard? With him waiting so handy? I shuddered. It was the first shark I'd seen, and though I thought the 3 fish made a wonderful picture to look at, I hated to think myself part of that picture. We both refused to fall overboard, and we walked about the ship all day with delicate care, wondering if sharks ever leapt from the water, and hoping that this shark was not a leaper. The swish of his tail on the surface of the water, when, after coming close up, he turned and dived below, made me tremble. I suggested prodding him with a boat hook, but the mate, who was then steering, thought that we had better not make him angry. The calm, clear blue water through which we could see fathoms down, the 2 gorgeous streaks of colour gliding always in order by the side of the hungry shark, and overhead the dome of blue sky and brilliant sunshine, made a vivid scene that impressed our imaginations. I wished I could paint, or at least that I had bought a camera to get a record of this combination of terror and beauty. And I shall always be able to recall the scene and the thrill and the pleasure with which we last saw the shark fade off, down and away, when he was convinced that the Joan would not supply him with a meal. Another day, after visiting a weed-covered barrel that we saw floating, we observed many fish accompanying the Joan. They were about a foot long and 4 inches thick, grey mottled in colour, a score or more of them. They seemed almost tame and would come within an inch or two of our hands as we washed the plates over the side. We wanted to catch one to eat, but our artful devices for doing this failed. No hooks and no baits could be found aboard. The mate bent a piece of wire to look a bit like a hook and tempted them with it. He tied a strip of shirt over the hook and still they refused to bite. He lowered a pail with a glittering toy inside. They grew more interested, but contemptuous as well. Then he put out his hook again and pulled it quickly back. To our surprise, the fish rushed frantically after the hook. He played with them for a few minutes in this manner and then took the boat hook. This he swished backwards and forwards in the water, and sure enough, all the fish rushed after it and tried to eat it. Presently, one of them did grab the hook in its mouth, and by a skillful and lucky swig of the boat hook, the fish was jerked into the air and fell on the foredeck. The mate immediately pinned it there with his boat hook until I got a sack into which I pushed it. When it was dead, we fried it, and I ate part of it. "Do you think it's good to eat?" asked the mate. "Why, it tastes good. How do you know it isn't poisonous?" I don't know. I'm taking the chance." But he ate his half. A few days after leaving Funchal, we had to adopt a steady diet of bully beef and ship's biscuit. The mate remarked, "You know, we ought to be covered with boils and pimples now." "Well, why?" "Living on bully beef and biscuits." "But we've lived on them for only a couple of weeks, all told." "Well, just so. But the men of the club I belong to always boast of a boil or two after a weekend trip down the river." Our diet, monotonous though it was, had an opposite effect upon us. Our complexions became perfect. An odd pimple or two vanished completely. We grew fitter and harder, the worse our food became. I said once in the early days, "These cracknels are not over grand. I found a piece of wood in one just now." "That's nothing," replied the mate. "I found a copper tack in the last egg I had." "Pure poetry." "No, it isn't. The last egg was made into an omelette." "Oh, well, the copper tack must have fallen out of the galley roof while the omelette was cooking." The mate propounded a quaint theory regarding tea drinkers. After breakfast, for which he had drunk one mug of tea and eaten one biscuit and cheese, he said, "My stomach's wrong again. I feel blown out. It's a funny thing, but I can drink pints and pints of beer and feel all the better for it, but a very little tea is enough to turn me up. By the way, you seem to be an exception to the rule that tea drinkers are no blessed good. I've never met anybody else who refused beer and drank a lot of tea who was any use. I don't understand it." "Don't try. Anybody whose brain is fuddled with beer is naturally incapable of understanding things. But it's a fact. I've noticed it. There are two categories of human beings. Those that like beer and those that like tea. The first are all right and the second are, well, all wrong." Time never hung heavy on our hands, and although we should have liked to shorten this passage, it was not because we were bored. For instance, on August the 25th, I called the mate 10 minutes before midnight. Putting my head into the cabin, I called sweetly, "Watch ahoy!" Naturally, there was no response. My ordinary polite conversational tone did not carry to that part of Byford's brain which was used to wake him up. It is a part deep down and hidebound. I knew this even though I made it a rule to give it a chance to respond as it ought. 15 seconds later, I yelled, my best and loudest hail. That reached him. He grunted and opened one eye. "Time's up," I said, and returned to the tiller. Slowly he rolled over and back while his brain said to him, "If I let myself go off to sleep again, that wretch won't come and call me again. He'll go on and do my watch and let me wake up on my own, and then I shall be damn well ashamed of myself." So he hoisted himself grudgingly off the bunk, stood up, yawned and rubbed his eyes, and asked with forced cheerfulness, "Any wind?" "Very little, just enough to steer by and to make you feel sleepy." "Any clothes wanted?" "Well, I've got my usual storm togs on, and I'm not uncomfortably warm." "Then I'd better put mine on." Whereupon he pulled himself into rubber boots, jacket and overcoat, and came out. "What's the course?" "North-northwest is the best I've been able to do, and I estimate we've done about 8 miles. I went into the cabin, entered up the course and distance run in our logbook, and made a brief remark upon conditions. Remarks were always brief at midnight. Then I cleared my bunk of all the stuff Byford had stowed there and undressed, taking off rubber thigh-high boots, stockings, overcoat, jacket and sweater. This left me in a night costume of shirt and trousers. I never turned in at night with less on, for there was sometimes a call for me to come on deck when I was off watch, and I always wanted to get there within 5 seconds. But that sleep from midnight to 4 o'clock was the sweetest rest I ever got. It came on alternate nights. I was then thoroughly sleepy and dropped off in less than half a minute after getting into the bunk. That half minute was a delight. To be able to shut your eyes after compelling them to keep open for 4 hours against their will, to let your mind wander off where it chose to go instead of compelling it to pay attention to a compass card, to let all your muscles relax in place of being everlastingly alert and active, these made a half minute of concentrated pleasure. I always lay on my back, a position I had to train myself to put up with. It was impossible to go to sleep on your side, for the boat rolled you over. The equilibrium was unstable. Byford had to do this as well. Almost immediately I was asleep. The mate's voice called, "Watch ahoy, nearly 4 o'clock." I rose quickly, and having inquired what it was advisable to wear, I dressed as before and came out. "Any change?" "No, course north-northwest, wind very light, 6 miles," and the mate disappeared. As soon as he had turned in and the cabin was clear, I pulled the jib aweather and stepped down to boil a mug of coffee. 10 minutes sufficed for this, and I was able to sail the boat again while I sipped the pint of hot, strong coffee. As the sun rose higher, I had to take off my clothing piece by piece until by 6 a.m. all I required was a sun hat, and that was all I wore. We had each bought a straw hat of the kind worn by carters in Vigo, with a very wide brim and without a ribbon or any other kind of ornament. I could see the mate curled up, covered and asleep on his bunk, with a gyrating sunbeam playing to and fro upon the blanket that covered his head. There was hardly a breeze to sail by, not enough at least to make it worth the labour of constant attention, and so I let the Joan wobble along as she liked. She liked a speed of half a knot. We were then in latitude 42 degrees north, longitude 17 degrees west, leaving the minutes out of account, and really they did not matter. This wording of our position does not convey much meaning to those who do not navigate. The Joan, then, was 350 miles west of Cap Finisterre, and she had sailed less than half the distance from Madeira to Falmouth. She was 560 miles north of Madeira and 720 miles southwest of the Lizard Head, which was to be her landfall. The mailboat takes 4 days from Madeira to Southampton. We had been 20 days at sea already. Since leaving the islands, we had seen no land, and we did not want to see any until we reached England. Patches of white cloud were scattered over a blue sky, which they delicately relieved. The sea had a gentle ocean swell ruffled by tiny wavelets. 24 hours later, we would be riding to a sea anchor among big breaking waves in a wind of gale force. It was to be a startling contrast. During the last hour of my watch, I had been observing some forms of marine life. Floating by were tiny blobs of jelly of various shapes, dotted and striated with spots and lines in a mass of melted spiderweb. Sometimes a larger one passed, a real jellyfish with graceful waving fronds. There were little cylinders of jelly with a yellow point. They looked like tiny harmless torpedoes. Some were gleaming red inside, others marked with yellow and brown spots. One showed what seemed to be a digestive system which could be seen through its body. Many came to the surface and made bubbles. They all gleamed with a phosphorescent light in the water, but then even a milk tin did that. Fastened to the hull of the Joan were scores of flowers, as the mate called them. They were, however, animals, and I collected a group of them in a bowl of water. This was placed in the cockpit so that I could watch the creatures while I steered. They continually poked out a little bunch of feathers from their shell. The bunch grasped a tiny handful of water, which it appeared to draw into the shell. These little beasts were ship's barnacles, the kind that grow in warm waters. They flourished exceedingly on the hull of the Joan. We scraped off as many as we could with a table knife lashed to the end of a stick, but as we could not reach far below the waterline, owing to the shape of the boat, the creatures grew to a sickening size and number. We sometimes wondered how much their presence prolonged the passage. Still, whenever a good favourable wind did spring up, off we scudded, barnacles and all. The sea, as I looked towards the horizon, was an undulating field of mottled shadows, but when I gazed directly down over the boat's side, the colour was a vision of purity and beauty. I never thought that a single colour could be so fine, a soft, pale blue shimmering with its own light. I have read of the sea being turquoise, but as I have never seen a turquoise and know nothing of its colour, this simile makes only a doggerel appeal to my senses. I don't believe that any word description would give a truthful impression of the colour of this sea. The mate was already up and doing, and at 8 o'clock he brought out the sextant. He handed me the watch we used for a chronometer, which gave us what we hoped was the correct time at Greenwich Observatory, or GMT. Then he chose his position on the boat for taking the sun's altitude. This morning it was on the deck by the weather shrouds. When he was satisfied with his observation, he called out to me, "Now!" and I noted the exact time by our chronometer. Then he took the tiller and the watch while I took an observation in the same manner as he had done. I went below, stowed the watch away carefully, winding it fully before I did so. Then I worked out the longitude sight and changed places with the mate while he worked his. My next job was breakfast. For this I had 2 boiled eggs, one of which was a bad one, and a biscuit with marmalade. Byford had had his breakfast before he took over the watch. Tea he had made for 2, so I had no need for a fresh boiling. By this time it was 9 o'clock, and as a routine of duty, I turned in on my bunk till 11 o'clock to sleep. I rose full of energy, which I displayed by putting my bed and blankets on deck to air and by opening the lockers under my bunk, and I tidied the forecastle. After this, I peeled 12 onions and lit the stove to cook the dinner. Just before noon, we took the sun's height again with the sextant and kept observing its height until it began to drop. If the greatest height be found in this way, a simple subtraction and addition sum will give you your latitude. This method is so straightforward, easy and certain that it has always been used by navigators. Even in the days of Columbus, it was easy to find your latitude near enough for practical purposes. So it was with us on the Joan. It was about the only thing in our navigation that we could be sure of. We fried onions, warmed a tin of bully beef, mixed the two together in the frying pan and served with the ship's biscuit. For a second course, we had 3 bananas and a piece of cheese. The bananas were delicious. We brought about 100 from Madeira. They were green and hard, but Coelho, who gave them to us, said that they would ripen if we kept them warm, dry and in the dark. My mind misgave me when I heard that they were to be kept warm and dry. But day by day, we examined them, and they remained hard and green while a fortnight passed. "Those bananas will have to be thrown overboard," I said. "They'll all go rotten before they ripen." But one day, the mate shouted, "What do I see? Ah, and again, ah, something yellow." A few of the bananas were indeed yellow, and these we ate at once. "These are not really ripe, you know," said the mate, who is an authority on bananas. "You ought to taste them when they are really soft and ripe. Absolutely delicious. Nothing on earth to touch them." We had bananas every day after that until they were all gone. When the bananas and eggs had been eaten, we were really and truly on the ship's stores. Our daily menu became as follows. 6 a.m. tea, 1 pint. 8 a.m. breakfast, biscuit and marmalade with or without tinned butter. Noon, dinner, A, bully beef and onions, biscuit and cheese, or B, baked beans, tinned peaches or pears. 4 p.m., tea, 1 pint. 8 p.m., supper, biscuit and marmalade or butter or cheese, sardines on alternate days. The biscuits were the ordinary ship's biscuit, of which we had a bagful given us at Vigo. When these were finished, we went on to the cabin biscuits, which we had bought at Falmouth. The cheese was Dutch in balls of 4 pounds. We bought 4 balls in Falmouth, and they kept well. They were occasionally dusted with boric acid powder. As for the bully beef, we hoped our heaviest curses would alight on the head of the manufacturer. Not a single tin opened fairly by means of the key supplied. Each had to be torn open by pliers. The onions were poor in quality, but their quality was much superior to that of the vinegar in which they were pickled. The baked beans were dear, but good. Therefore, they were cheap. The mate was greatly dissatisfied one day. He complained of the biscuits going mouldy, the marmalade fermenting, the sugar smelling of mildew. He went on to say that we had only one glass left for the compass lamp, the rest having been broken by wet dripping upon the hot glass, that the water came through the hatch, that his rubber boots had more holes in them than when they were bought, and so on. It was a worthy grouse. I might have added that all our best Sunday boots were covered in a green fluff, that the straw baskets brought from Funchal sent out clouds of powdery mildew whenever they were touched, and that the forecastle was always chock full. "I wish I had something tasty to eat," said he at tea time. "Not that I'm hungry, but I'm nearly fed up with marmalade." At 4 p.m, we again changed the watch. This time, Byford was on duty for only 2 hours, and I followed at 6 p.m. for another 2 hours. These are the dog watches, by means of which a change was made on alternate days. It would never do to allow the same man to enjoy the watch from midnight every day. We had tea during the first dog watch, and the man off duty used to make a point of getting in an hour's sleep. At 4 p.m. or thereabouts, we used to take another altitude. It will be seen from this account of a calm and lazy day that our time was plentifully occupied. Any spare time we generally felt ought to be spent in sleep, but there were books aboard. You could read if you felt like it. It was seldom that we felt like it. Being hove to one day when the sea was bad, I had remarked how convenient it was to be able to remain as we were without any traffic problem to worry over. "I don't suppose there's a boat within 50 miles of us," I said, and not 5 minutes after, we heard a steamer's whistle. We scrambled out of the cabin in frantic haste, and there, 100 yards to windward, was a small steamer lying to. All the crew were on the deck, gazing at us. We laughed and waved our arms cheerfully and then hoisted our red ensign. To this, they replied by waving all their arms and hoisting the Portuguese flag. Then, with many more waves, they rolled and pitched on their way. I thought it a pleasant little how-d'ye-do in the middle of the ocean. Still, we did not always have smooth seas and light winds. During our third week out, we had some very strong winds, some in our favour, but these raised a bad sea. One occasion was bad enough to induce us to try our sea anchor. On the 18th day out, we made the experiment for the first time, and we were delighted with the result. It answered admirably. Practically no water came aboard. We had no need to pump out, and for a deal of the time, the sliding hatch was open just as we were accustomed to have it in calm weather. We were able to get a good long sleep. 10 days later, after another interval, we put the sea anchor out for the second time. On September 12th, 5 weeks after leaving Funchal, we picked up the real westerly winds. We were then 500 miles west of the Scillies, and although we were covered with barnacles, the wind was strong enough to send us along at a pleasing speed. At 8 o'clock on the 13th of September, the Cunarda Andania passed close to us. We hoisted the red ensign, and Byford held up our sextant as a signal that we wanted to know our position. We thought that from the bridge of the steamer this would be seen and guessed at, so that she would tell us as she passed by. At first we thought she was taking no notice, but after she had gone ahead, she hoisted the blue ensign and turned back. Then we were not sure what was best to do, to steer alongside the Andania or heave to and wait for her. A few moments' reflection, however, showed us that we had better keep our course, steer as straight as we could, and leave the Andania to manage things. So I glued my eyes to the compass card and took no notice of anything else. As soon as the mate told me that she was nearly alongside, I changed my position so as to steer without the compass and to look about me. The sight was one that left a vivid impression upon me. The big liner was literally 30 yards away, and her towering sides went up like a cliff. On top of this cliff was a crowd of people gazing down upon us. We felt small. The ship moved very slowly past us, and I know enough about the circumstances to admire the skill with which she had been brought so close to us in this seaway. Someone gave us our position, shouting through a megaphone. The mate repeated the figures aloud, and I said them over again to myself. Yet, a few minutes later, we found that neither of us was absolutely certain of anything but the one number which we had been anxious to hear. There was no doubt that 12 degrees long had been called, and I knew at once that our watches were going on well enough. They were there or thereabouts, and we could be sure of not hitting the sillies a week before we expected to be near them. But all the same, we ought to have written our position down at once. The Andania asked if she could give us any further assistance, and we replied no. As soon almost as we had said the word and the Andania had begun to forge ahead, the mate turned to me. There, hanged if I didn't forget all about the grub. Dash it, it's too late now. We'll have to keep on with our two biscuits a day and bully beef with marmalade for another week. Can't you smell the joints of meat and hear the beer being poured out? Hang it too, another couple of days and my last pipeful of plug will be done. Hurry up, you westerly winds. In the middle of the next night, the mate bathed. He shouted to me to come out and look at him. When I saw him, he was hanging desperately to the mizzen shroud and the rail on the port side, and a good half of him was having a bath. The upper part was holding tight. With a little encouragement, he struggled aboard, and after rapidly describing the motive that had induced him to choose so unusual a time and place, he demanded the dregs of the cognac bottle. I shivered a bit when I imagined how he might not have been able to hold on tight. From now on, we had plenty of wind from the direction we wanted it, but the quantity of it was often too much for us. Over and over again did we have to give up sailing and lie to our sea anchor until the weather moderated, but the sea anchor always worked well, and so long as we were clear of the land, we felt quite safe. We grew skillful and quick in the handling of it. We could not often keep the hatch open. Breaking waves frequently struck the boat and smothered her with water. As the Joan rolled on the falling slope of a big wave, she used to swing her quarter, crashing down on the rising slope of the next one. Her stern, on occasion, was forced down until a swirl of water swung over the taffrail, but she shipped no water that had to be pumped out. A good lookout had to be kept during this part of our journey. We were nearing the Scilly Isles, and we were in the line along which the Atlantic traffic to and from the channel converges. Our riding light was a good one and burned steadily and brightly, yet it was, after all, only a small flame placed 8 feet above the waterline. Most of the waves rose higher than our lamp, and we ran great risk if we trusted to its being seen. So a watch had to be kept, and if a vessel approached and seemed to be ignorant that we were in its path, we had to light a flare to call attention to the fact that we existed. We could do nothing to avoid being run down, so that it was necessary to make sure that the steamer saw us in time to steer clear. We remained on our sea anchor the best part of 2 days before we were able to set sail again. 12 hours later, the sea anchor had to go over once more, and even a third time after another period of sailing. We seemed to be sea anchoring towards the land now instead of sailing. During the last few hours that we were on our sea anchor, I saw a reflection to the northeast. After careful examination, we concluded that it was Bishop's Rock Light, at least 18 miles away. So far as we could judge, the wind was driving us on a course parallel with the islands and towards the Lizard. But the books said that a current set towards the land, and we were not positive about our distance from it. There we were absolutely helpless. The boat could not be sailed in that sea, and it was no use holding up a flare to tell an island to get out of your way. We were fortunate enough not to be driven ashore. The sea anchor was stowed the next afternoon, and we set sail on a course for the Lizard. When it became dark, we were once more anxiously on the lookout for the lights, especially to pick up St. Mary's. The reflection of a definite flashing light was seen. It was St. Mary's, of course. We expected to find St. Mary's. I timed it carefully and referred to the light list, but it did not agree with the period given of St. Mary's. Was anything wrong? What other light could possibly be seen but St. Mary's? Now, I had had experience before of trusting to my common sense after it had been humbugged by this kind of suggestion, and it had led me to a bad end. I determined to be on my guard this time. If this light did not correspond in period with St. Mary's, then it wasn't going to be St. Mary's, not for me. I went on deck, hung onto the shrouds, and shouted the period aloud so that the mate who was steering could time it as well as I. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. And so on. There could be no doubt. This period was the period of the Lizard light, yet how could we see that from so low down as we were? The lizard light was visible to us for about a dozen miles, and here were the reflections showing plainly when we were 40 miles away. It was hard to believe. Bishop's Rock reflections could be timed, and so could this at the same time. There were no others. Surely St. Mary's must show before the lizard, and surely the wolf light ought to be seen by us before we saw the lizard. But there it was. There were no others, so I concluded that the reflections which we saw came from the lizard, even though my common sense tried to suggest that it ought to be St. Mary's. If the light was the lizard, we ought to go straight for it. If it was St. Mary's, we ought not. We went directly for it, and of course it was the lizard. I have often had a similar experience with a compass course, my common sense telling me that the compass was wrong. But navigation instruments, charts and books have one great virtue. They are not open to suggestion. We were both now pleased that we were so near our port. A fair wind, such as we now had, would soon bring us the few miles to Falmouth. It was my watch from 8 to 12, and the fact that we had weathered a gale or two, and that we had fought through a long and wearying passage, and that we were now on our last day's run, made me particularly cheerful, and so perhaps less watchful over myself. I sang aloud, and the mate heard my songs. They were not conducive to slumber, and he said so, but what do I care? Who wanted to sleep on the last lap? So I took no notice of his objection. He objected again, strongly, and after a few words on each side, he explained that if he didn't get any sleep, he wouldn't be able to take his watch at midnight. Very well, if you want to dodge your turn, dodge it and be damned, and no more was said then. When midnight came, he got up and began to put on overcoat and oilskins as usual. "Oh, you may turn in," said I. "As you want to get out of the job, I'm quite able to carry on." The mate said nothing. He grabbed a piece of biscuit and cheese and sat down to munch it and think matters over. When he had finished, he stood up in the cabin and looked out at me. "Look here, do you want to do anything that we shall both be sorry for afterwards?" "No, of course I don't. But if I were on your boat and refused to take my turn, what would you do?" "Well, never mind about that now. If there's anything to say or do about it, let's talk it over tomorrow, not now." There was a slight pause. "All right, come and take the tiller." This was the only little squabble we had all through the cruise. The long journey was made with almost no friction between us. In fact, Byford and I lived in our narrow quarters with surprising good temper. Whatever poor opinions we conceived of one another, we contrived to suppress, and I am sure that they really ceased the moment bad weather came and we had to set about reefing or sea anchoring. Whenever the wind blew mightily, it carried off with it any little fume of growing disagreement. Every evening when we set up our lamp in the mizzen rigging, we found it had to be a two-man job. It had to be tied by hand as high as I could reach, and while I did this, the lamp had to be supported so that it would not swing against the mast and shrouds. I could not use both hands unless Byford held me from being slung overboard. I'm not sentimental, but I always experienced a curiously pathetic feeling of helplessness and thankfulness while the mate was flattening me against the mizzenmast in his efforts to keep me and himself safely aboard. I know for my own part that I came down into the cockpit each dusk after the lamp had been tied, feeling that a fresh bond had been forged in goodwill between us. We brought up at Falmouth at 6 p.m. September the 21st, and went across to St. Maur's next day to pick up our dinghy. Well, that's the end of today's reading. I hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, where for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast. If you do want to engage with more of the content there, there's unique videos, more podcasts, blogs, lots of different things, and a growing community of people who are interested in all things sailing. That's patreon.com/themariner. Well, that's all from the Mariner's Library today, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.